From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I got involved in the movement when I was a student at Morehouse College in Atlanta in 1960. I was sitting in a cafe. There's a chain of black drugstores in Atlanta called Yates and Milton's, and this was right across the street from Morehouse College. It's a place where you went in between classes or instead of classes. And I was sitting there, and a fellow student I knew only as a football player, his name was Lonnie King, no relation to the famous King family, and he held up the newspaper and said, "Have you seen this?" And I thought he was asking, "Do you read the newspaper?" And I was a little put off because I thought every college student either did or should read a newspaper every day. But really he meant, "Had you seen this story?" And the story talked about Greensboro students sitting in for the third day. And it told how these students had gone to the local F&W Woolworths department store, had bought something over here and over here, and then bought something over here, then sat at the lunch counter and asked for service or refused service, and sat there until the store closed and said, "We'll be back tomorrow."
Julian Vaughn, former chairman of the NAACP. This past April, the LBJ Presidential Library on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin hosted a Civil Rights Summit to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The summit featured three former presidents and President Obama. It also looked back at the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s and looked forward to the civil rights issues still facing America and the world. The summit was entitled, "We Shall Overcome." President Johnson began his quest for a more just and honorable America with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the most transformational civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, and a critical step in the realization of America's promise. In the years that follow, LBJ passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Together, these three laws ban discrimination based on race, color, sex, religion, or national origin. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, highlights of the Civil Rights Summit to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 with Julian Bond, Andrew Young, and John Lewis in Black America.
Well, the Civil Rights Movement, the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr. and others, created the climate, created the environment for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Hundreds and thousands of young people been arrested, going to jail. Churches been bombed, burned. On April the 19th, 1960, our attorney home near Fisk University, Z. Alexander Lubin, one of the most respected citizens of the city of Nashville. People didn't like it. Because his home was bombed, he was an elected official, distinguished lawyer, had worked with Thurgood Marshall. Before noon that morning, his home was bombed, like 6:30. By 7 o'clock, we were in a meeting. We sent a telegram to the mayor of the city and said, "Meet us at high noon at City Hall."
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a revolutionary piece of legislation in this country that effectively outlawed egregious forms of discrimination against African Americans and women, including all forms of segregation. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 terminated unequal application in regards to voter registration requirements and all forms of racial segregation in schools, in the workplace, and by facilities that offer services to the general public. On July 2, 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed into law the historic Civil Rights Act. This past April, for 3 days, the LBJ Presidential Library on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin hosted a Civil Rights Summit to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The summit was entitled, "We Shall Overcome." On today's edition of In Black America, we highlight the heroes of the Civil Rights Movement with Julian Bond, former chairman of the NAACP. While a student at Morehouse, he helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and served as communication director. Andrew Young, former congressman, ambassador to the United Nations, and mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, and John Lewis, U.S. representative from the 5th Congressional District. The discussion was moderated by Lonnie G. Bunch, founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Let me begin this by asking you to talk a little bit about your early involvement in the movement. Congressman Lewis, you talk a lot about how you were told not to get in trouble. I'm wondering, for the three of you, what led you to trouble the water, to pick up the gauntlet of civil rights.
Well, thank you very much, Lonnie. I'm delighted and very pleased to be here. I'm honored. I grew up in rural Alabama, about 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. And when I was growing up, I saw the signs. I didn't like the signs that I saw, saying white only, white waiting, colored waiting. And I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way, don't get in trouble. But in 1955, at the age of 15, I heard about Rosa Parks, heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on the radio. And the action of Rosa Parks, the words and leadership of Dr. King inspired me to find a way to get in the way. And I got in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. I remember in 1956, at the age of 16, with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we went down to the public library in the little town of Troy, trying to get a library card, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library is for color only, for whites only, not for colors. Many years later, Julia and I went back to the same library, July 5th, 1998, for a book signing of my book, Walking with the Wind. And I was given a library card. And years, I'll make it short, Lonnie, years later, I met Dr. King. I first met Rosa Parks in 1957 when I was 17. The next year, 1958, I met Martin Luther King Jr. Changed my life. And I haven't looked back. You cannot look back. To get involved, I went off to school to Nashville, started studying the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, deeply moved by the teaching of a young man by the name of Jim Lawson that we know very well. He taught us the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. In Nashville, we had nonviolent workshop every Tuesday night near Fisk University during the fall of 1959 and the early part of 1960. We studied what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied Thoreau in civil disobedience. We studied what Dr. King was all about in Montgomery. And black and white college students and some high school students would have these test sit-ins, and someone would come and pull us off the lunch counter stool, spit on us, put lighted cigarettes out in our hair or down our backs. But most of us in Nashville in 1960 accepted the way of nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living.
Thank you. Julian?
Well, I got involved in the movement when I was a student at Morehouse College in Atlanta in 1960. I was sitting in a cafe. There's a chain of black drugstores in Atlanta called Yates and Milton's, and this was right across the street from Morehouse College. It's a place where you went in between classes or instead of classes. And I was sitting there, and a fellow student I knew only as a football player, his name was Lonnie King, no relation to the famous King family, and he held up the newspaper and said, "Have you seen this?" And I thought he was asking, "Do you read the newspaper?" And I was a little put off because I thought every college student either did or should read a newspaper every day. But really he meant, had you seen this story? And the story talked about Greensboro students sitting in for the third day. And it told how these students had gone to the local F&W Woolworths department store, had bought something over here and over here, and then bought something over here, then sat at the lunch counter and asked for service or refused service, and sat there until the store closed and said, "We'll be back tomorrow." And described how they were dressed, how they comported themselves. It was like how to sit in. And he said to me, "Have you seen this?" I said, "Oh yes, I've seen that." He said, "What do you think about it?" I said, "I think it's great, it's wonderful." He said, "Don't you think it ought to happen here in Atlanta?" And I said, "Oh, it's gonna happen here in Atlanta. I know it's gonna happen here in Atlanta." And before he said, "Why don't we make it happen?" And before I could say, "What do you mean we?" he said, "You take this side of the cafe, I'll take this side of the cafe, and we'll call a meeting and we'll make it happen." And we were in the middle of a complex of black schools, Morehouse College, which was for men, Spelman College, which was for women, Clark College, which is coeducational, Morris Brown College, which is coeducational, Atlanta University, the graduate school, and the Interdenominational Theological Center, which was the collection of theological schools. So we made sure we had somebody from each of these schools because we didn't want it to be a Morehouse College event only. And when we thought we had a mass of people, then we had our first sit-in demonstrations. And I was chosen to lead people to the cafeteria at the Atlanta City Hall. And you got to City Hall by going up a set of stairs and then going to the basement, and the cafeteria was there. So I led this group of about 15 people, men and women, to the cafeteria. And we came in the cafeteria and we saw these black women working at the steam tables there. And they're looking at us with a mixture of fear and admiration. Fear because they'd read in the papers about sit-in demonstrations. Now they were coming to Atlanta. And one thing that was certain, being arrested would follow. And they thought the police would come and they'd be a little nervous about that. But admiration because they also admired what we were doing and they were glad that they were a part of it. So we go through the steam tables, we come up to the cashier, which I later found out a white woman was the manager of the cafeteria, and she's awfully polite. You know, Southerners are so polite. She said, I'm awfully sorry, this is for City Hall employees only. I said, you have a big sign out front that says City Hall Cafeteria, the public is welcome. She said, we don't mean it. I said, we'll stand here until you do, and she called the police. The police came and arrested us and took us away. And for the first time in my life, I found myself in jail. And because so many of us had been arrested in so many different times and places around Atlanta, they decided to try one person for each group of arrestees. And I was chosen to be tried for mine. And so I found myself for the first time in my life before a judge and standing between two men whom I'd never seen before. I found out they were my lawyers. One, an older man, Colonel A.T. Walden, who was the dean of black lawyers in Georgia, and the younger man, Attorney Hollowell, who was the younger of the two and his protege. And there's a little back and forth between the judge and my lawyers, which I really don't understand. And then the judge said to me, how do you plead? And I was really didn't quite know what to say. On the one hand, I knew I had the right to be there. This is a state-supported public place. My taxes paid for it. I had a right to be in this cafeteria. But on the other hand, a policeman had asked me to leave, and I didn't leave, so I disobeyed the policeman. So was I guilty? Was I not guilty? I turned to Attorney Hollowell, and he was like this. And I was, you know, my heart sank. And I turned to the older man. The younger man said, not guilty, you fool. And I had the quickness of mind not to say that, or else I wouldn't be standing here now. So I was bound over to a grand jury and sent back to my cell, and later we were all arrested, and that's how I got into the civil rights movement.
Ambassador Young?
You know, I almost think I was born into it in New Orleans. I grew up in a neighborhood with an Irish grocery store on one corner, an Italian bar, and the Nazi party on the third corner. I mean, I was 3-4 years old, and I could see these people heiling Hitler. Wow. And my father took me to see Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympic films. And he told me that white supremacy is a sickness. And you don't get upset with sick people, you help them. And he used Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens won the 100-meter dash, and Hitler got up and stormed out. And he said, now, Jesse didn't get mad. He just went on and won 3 more gold medals. And he said, don't get mad. If you lose your temper in a fight, you lose the fight. Don't get mad, get smart. And so in that neighborhood, we were in a civil rights movement day by day. And then you had to go to a segregated school on the other side of town. And that was class warfare. Because my parents had been to college and nobody else in the school had. So you either had to run, fight, or negotiate. And I learned to do all 3 when appropriate.
You know, I wonder, earlier today you started to talk, the earlier panel, about the sort of impact of the movement on the Civil Rights Act of 64. Sitting here, you are the people who shaped the Freedom Riders, shaped the SNCC voter registration issues, shaped the Birmingham campaign. Help us understand how you see the movement shaping and making possible the Civil Rights Act of 64?
Well, the Civil Rights Movement, the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr. and others, created the climate, created the environment for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There were hundreds and thousands of young people been arrested, going to jail. Churches been bombed, burned. On April the 19th, 1960, our training home near Fisk University, Z. Alexander Lubin, one of the most respected citizens of the city of Nashville. People didn't like it. Because his home was bombed, he was an elected official, distinguished lawyer, had worked with Thurgood Marshall. Before noon that morning, his home was bombed, like 6:30. By 7 o'clock, we were in a meeting. We sent a telegram to the mayor of the city and said, meet us at high noon at City Hall. More than 4,000 students marched in an orderly fashion. And all across the South, people were demanding action. The NAACP had a slogan, free by 63, Julian. And you can be sitting in the student union or the cafeteria at Fisk, and the African students would be saying to us, the whole of Africa would be free and liberated, and we couldn't get a hot dog and a Coca-Cola at a lunch counter. So we've been challenged. People didn't like what they saw. I remember when I first got arrested the first time, I felt free. I felt liberated. And I think many of us felt that way, that you come to that point where you cannot go back, you have to go forward. And we continue to push. Remember in June of 1963, President Kennedy made a speech, I believe it was June 11, 1963, when he spoke to the nation. And a few days later, the so-called Big Six, the leaders of the NAACP, the Urban League, the NAACP, I said, Dr. King, Brigham Young, A. Philip Randolph. Yeah. We met in New York City on July 2nd, 1963. And in that meeting, we said we were going to march on Washington. A. Philip Randolph been wanting to march against Roosevelt, against Truman, and this was his chance. He wanted to march. And he told the president, we're going to march. And later, we met and organized and invited four major white religious and labor leaders to join us. And the March on Washington, I think, was one of the finest hours. And I might say here, when I look back on it, Julian, I think it was one, and Andy, I think it was one of the great undercount. The media said 250,000. I think it was many more. It was a sea of humanity. When the program was over, people still trying to come into Washington to participate in that march on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
So would you agree, Ambassador, that moments like the March on Washington were crucial in shaping the federal government's response, which ultimately led to the Civil Rights Act?
Well, I think what John had done and what Julian had done in the student sit-ins had created a movement. It was followed by the Freedom Rides. The Freedom Rides left SNCC students, for the most part, camped out or planted throughout Mississippi. We were training workers with the Citizenship Education Program. There was really a Southwide movement of people for equal rights. The March on Washington was sort of a culmination of that movement. I don't think we could have just announced the movement and had it, a march, and had it succeed that way. It took the Freedom Rides, it took the sit-ins, it took Medgar Evers' death, it took the all of the sufferings that we had built up through the years. And what the march did was took a Southern, predominantly black movement and make it a national, multiracial, multicultural movement.
You know, John is the only surviving speaker from the March on Washington. John is one of the few people who participated in had a leadership role in the sit-ins in Nashville, then in the Freedom Rides, then in Freedom Summer in Mississippi, then in almost everything that happened in the movement. This man has been into everything and been into almost every jail. and he really is a signal figure that is just a wonderful, wonderful person.
Well, Julian, it's very kind of you to suggest that, but I must tell you, I was deeply moved by the action of hundreds and thousands of brave and courageous people, especially young people, and also by what I call the spirit of history. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to find a way to get in the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you move and inspire to speak up and speak out and make a little noise. And that's what I tell people today. I say, you're just too quiet. You need to make some noise.
One of the things.
Julian, for instance, just voted against the war in Vietnam in the Georgia legislation, yeah. Got put out.
Well, I took a position against my organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. John Lewis, as the chairman, took a position against the war in Vietnam, and as a consequence, my colleagues to be in the Georgia State Legislature expelled me or wouldn't allow me to be admitted and declared my seat vacant and declared a new election to be held. And I ran in that election and I won that election. And I was put out again and they threw me out again. And then I ran in another election and won that election and then went to the Supreme Court and won that court case too. So it was a long, long haul up there.
That's part of the message. People are looking for a quick fix. Mm. And they say, where's the movement now? I don't know. But it's probably on somebody's iPhone. Say, or iPad, somewhere. I mean, the Arab Spring mm-hmm. really would never have occurred in the 50s. But when a single worker who could not get his work permit to run his push cart in Tunis, decided after frustration to pour gasoline on himself and set himself on fire. Everybody took a picture of it, and it was all over the world in a matter of minutes. And that's where I think the next movements are going to come from.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andy, on this point, and Julian and Lenny, there was a little comic book that Martin Luther King Jr. helped edit.
Came out in 1957,
called The Montgomery Story, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story, mm-hmm. published by an organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Those of us in Nashville read it. The students in Greensboro mm-hmm. read it first. And people were saying, if they can do it in Greensboro, why can't we do it? Mm-hmm. And Jim Lawson used that comic book. It was only 14 pages and sold for 10 cents. And that same book was translated and used in Egypt mm-hmm. just 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so the message of the movement, the teaching of the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence been spreading around the world. And I think some historian many, many years ago, Arnold Toynbee, had predicted that maybe it would be the American Negro, he said, that would carry the message of nonviolence to the Western world.
If I can just do a shameless plug of somebody else's work, is Judgment Days by Nick Kotz. You can download that anytime, and you get a real feel for Dr. King and President Johnson. But The New Jim Crow by Michelle Griffith is another book that is telling us where our struggle is headed now. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we can't just look back. We've got to see where we're going now. And we're also, we still need a assurance of the right to vote, the right to have a social security card with your mm-hmm. picture on it mm-hmm. that would let you get your checks cashed or vote. All these are things that could be done almost instantly and automatically without a great deal of fight. In fact, It would save the government money if they automated their payments to individuals around and required them to have bank accounts and do everything electronically. I mean, it's just, they're good sense movements waiting to happen.
Right. Well, one of the things, absolutely. When the Smithsonian decided to help create a new National Museum of African American History and Culture, we surveyed tens of thousands of people about what they knew, what they wanted to know. And what was interesting was the notion that the civil rights movement was inevitable. More than anybody else, the public said to us, well, it was going to happen anyway. Yet the reality is, as we sit here, you all know how strategic you had to be, how difficult it was. And so I almost wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about a moment where you despaired, where you worried that this was really going to happen, and a moment where you suddenly realized that I think we can make this transformation that we've all sacrificed for.
I can answer that very easily. The moment of great despair I felt was when Dr. King was killed. I was not his best friend. I was not that close to him. I had a unique experience of being taught by him when he taught at Morehouse. But when he died, I felt as if one of my family members had died, somebody I knew closely, and that was not the case. I just felt everything we've worked for is over. It's all through, all finished. We're not gonna do anything else after this. That passed, obviously, and I was able to do things after that. And among one of the best movements I had was the first time I was arrested in Atlanta, at Atlanta City Hall. And like John, I had this feeling of freedom.
Yes.
As the policeman put me in the paddy wagon and then took me to jail and found myself in this enormous room with all these other men. And I said to myself, I better not ask them why they're here. but they asked us and knew, because they'd heard on the radio, they knew why we were there, and they were so happy to see us. And you just felt so good, so great.
Congressman, what about you?
Well, like Julian, when I heard that Dr. King had been assassinated, it was a sad time for me and a very dark hour. I love Dr. King. If it hadn't been for him, I don't know what would have happened to me.
John Lewis, U.S. Representative from the 5th Congressional District. We will continue our conversation on next week's program. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.